Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plato, and a man that I wish was silent and anonymous. It's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Now then, David, how are we?
I'm all right, thank you. But more to the point, how are you? Because you've not been well, have you, Jason Plato?
No, I've had... Do you know what? I've been the worst I've ever been in like 15 years. I've had proper man flu, which, as we all know, is going to be deathly.
Deadly.
And that as well. And then for the first time ever, I've had COVID, and then now a chest infection. So I'm on loads of pills, and I'm starting to feel a bit better. But yeah, I've spent best part of a week in the sack.
I'm amazed that it's taken you this long to get COVID. I mean, COVID's been around for the last, nearly 3 years now, and you haven't got it once.
No, not once.
You see, it's all that clean living, Mr. Plato. You know, you treating your body like a temple. That's why it's not got near you thus far.
Could quite possibly be that or something else. Maybe a bit of luck.
Bit of luck. And talking of luck, we are lucky men today because we have a very special guest.
We do. Our guest today... God, this is a mouthful because it goes on forever. He's a very highly decorated racing driver, a motoring journalist, an author, a TV presenter. We shared the screen a few times. A Hollywood stunt coordinator, a precision driver, and just about the fastest thing around Dunsfold test track ever. Some say that high-octane fuel runs through his veins and that he has a natural aversion to nutmeg and wearing Crocs. All we know is he used to be called a Stig. It's Ben Collins. Hello, mate. How are you?
Hey, guys. Yeah, great to be with you. How's it all going? Apart from you nearly dying. Sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it's, I mean, other than a near fatality for Mr. Plato, then life is pretty tickety-boo. Thank you very much.
Should have kept your helmet on. Then you'd have been impervious to it all.
Yes. How on earth did you keep that helmet on for so long? Because you generally had to wear it when you were on set. Is that true?
Yeah, well, I used to go further than, because really I was left to my own devices. The brief was fairly obvious and clear, which was to not let your identity get out there. So I decided that from the minute I was within a 5 mile radius of wherever I was going, Top Gear track in Dunsfold, the balaclava would go on. So I'd rock up so that I didn't want, because the security guard was bound to get used to you and all those things. Yeah. So that just took care of that problem. And I'd park in the middle of nowhere, and I'd brought nothing with my ID into the porter cabin or anywhere I used to hang out with the crew. So that would be it. But it did get some funny looks because it did look suspicious. It looked like a bank robber, whatever you want to call it. And then I would sort of slink off. I used to get changed in the – there was a room because Dunsfold used to be where they used to do all the R&D on Harriers, jump jets. So there's some amazing bits of history there. And I used to get changed in the old pilot's room, which was pretty derelict along with most of the rest of the aerodrome. And yeah, reappear, completely changed. So I was either, civvy mode with the balaclava or fully stigged up, and then the helmet didn't come off, except for a bit of breathing occasionally when I could get away with it.
Because, now I think about it, you've just, I guess you would have to do that because all it would take is one person and it will be out. And it was kept under wraps for how many years?
Well, I mean, initially, I think it was the best part of a year before even Clarkson knew who it was.
And that happened. Really? Yeah. Genuinely?
I think so. Because, there were two guys. So Andy Willman, who's the exec producer, and Tim Wiseman, who was one of the young producers that was helped making run the show, well, early days, researching and getting up to producer level. And no, not really anyone else. The camera crew just get some funny looks from them. But I was learning it. It was all fascinating. All these creatures, great and small, wearing North Face, pointing cameras. It was when they got into the live show. So that was at least a year. That was the first time because I was sitting in a motorhome, sort of hiding. And it turned out it must have been Clarkson's motorhome because he walked in, gave me a hell of a look as a sort of a who the hell are you look. As only he can do. And I was like, morning, and carried on reading a book or something. And Wilman's going, oh, this is Ben. And he said, oh, and that was that. Of course, once he knew, the snowball got a bit bigger and stuff, and it was like that. It just very gradually, more and more people in the organization got to know out of just sort of, I suppose, making life easy. But they were back, obviously he was going to find out,
That's amazing, Dave. I never knew that.
No, I didn't know that. Well, do you know what? I'd never really even thought about it, to be honest with you, because obviously we knew that in terms of the public, it was a big secret. We sort of knew that within the industry over time, people sort of knew. But then the idea that, I mean, you hear about people being in character all day, don't you? Sort of actors on set and also TV presenters. And I've actually experienced it sometimes, and it's actually really, really odd, especially with Keith Lemon. That was a strange one. But anyway, that's another story. But then the idea of you sort of pulling into a little lay-by or something on the way to work to then sort of assume the role and then not actually coming out of it until you've effectively exited for the day is bonkers, but necessary. Yeah.
It was very antisocial because, I mean, you know what it's like, Jason. You've done tons of TV and you hang out with the crew when it's all done and they've had beer or something like that together. And I saw, you know, that'd be me, like just disappear out into the ether because I couldn't go and hang out, chat. And even early on, though, I had a fairly good instinct for what I should do. And I remember one of the days, we got infiltrated. So there was a Dutch presenter came over. She was a good-looking lady, and I think that basically just mugged everybody because they let her sort of right into the nerve center of Top Gear, and I got pushed forward and said, "Go and do an interview." And I said, "But I shouldn't do an interview with this person because the Stig's not supposed to speak on camera, and my voice will be recognized." Oh no, it doesn't matter. Dutch TV, no one will see it. But that was in sort of 2003, because before YouTube. Yeah. So ultimately, everybody did see that interview, which was really, really awkward because I knew I wasn't supposed to be doing it, but I'd been told to, and answering stupid questions, which then were on YouTube, and then everyone said, "Ah, that's Ben. I recognise that voice." A lot of the racing people did anyway.
Yeah, yeah, unbelievable,
isn't it? I mean, but what about what about lunch breaks and stuff like that, Ben? You know, I mean,
either through the visor, you can get some like stuff down into your mouth that way.
Come on, you weren't doing that in the canteen, were you? You weren't sitting all helmeted up in the canteen. Surely.
Canteen? Yeah. No, Dunsfold does not have a canteen. The closest we got to that was a double-decker bus. Okay. So that was quite good. So I used to get up to the top deck and I was fairly safe in there. Or I'd go and hide in my little Stig room, which is this sort of beaten down part of the cabin, and scoff my food there. But people would just walk in. So you always had to be ready for the unexpected. Good so Lord. I always had the helmet close. I always had it half on so I could just drop it down. And it saved me quite a few times. And the closest, who was it? Suzanne and Trini, the presenters.
Oh, the the fashion.
They tried to get in. Trying to break into the visor. Now, the funny enough, the paparazzi, they were quite inventive.
That's an image I'm not going to be able to leave.
Being helmet burgled by Trini and Susanna. There's probably a better expression than that, but I can't think of one at the minute.
They did. They tried to burgle my helmet. The Sunday Times broke into the porter cabin. And again, this is where it was. I'd sort of hidden everything, but they ran through my stuff. Couldn't find anything. So all they could write was the Stig's got size 10 feet. But the clever one was in Ireland, and there was a pap there. And they use these really high density flash photography cameras to sort of see through tinted windscreens and stuff. And that actually did quite a good job on the visor. And it went straight through and you could see a portion of face.
Right.
But is that right? Wow.
It's still not enough, you know.
So I mean, you know, let's rewind back a stage. How on earth did this all come about? Obviously with your racing driver history and a successful career, but how does that then transfer into what is arguably what you're best known for? You know, how did the Stig come? How did you become the Stig?
Well, I mean, Jason would sympathise with this. You know, as a racing driver, you throw that net as far as you can. You're looking desperately looking after, you know, for sponsors, trying to get as much support as you can to get through the racing ranks. And through that, I got at the time a big sponsorship deal from Top Gear magazine, £250 for the year, and. Yes.
Back of the net.
Yeah. Let's go and race Formula 3 with that. But it was all part and parcel. But it was an open door to, you know, a bit of publicity and what they were doing. And eventually had a good relationship with the mag and became more aware of what was going on in the sort of TV world. So, you know, Jason, you were on Driven, I think. Your series. Darren Manning was doing something. And it seems like a good, you know, this whole TV thing, this seems like a good way to get, you know, get somewhere in the racing world. So I did a couple of screen tests, which one with John Bentley, actually, was one of the original. He was one of the original.
I know John.
Aaron Clarkson. he obviously didn't think the same of me, and I told me to jog on. He didn't say that in so many words, obviously, but there wasn't a role there at the time or whatever.
Do you know what? I did a screen test with John Bentley, as he goes on, and I didn't get the gig either.
No. Maybe there wasn't a gig. Maybe he just wanted to meet us. I'm surely if there'd been a job, we'd have been hired instantly. But then, then I was then aware. Well, I had been previously that Top Gear existed, and I said, look, how do I get in touch with these people and see what's the crack? So after some pestering, I got, a CV was pushed in the right direction. And I sort of later learned that Wilman had a technique for filtering job applications or any applications, which was to pile them on his desk, take the top half and bin them and read the rest. So I was obviously in the lucky half.
Okay.
And then I got a chance.
It's like natural selection, really, but
I think, exactly. Long story short, I got to meet Wilman at the track, and that was where I did an audition. So they had a Ford Focus, fairly cold track, and they obviously knew what time it could go round. And this was in the era that predated me, if you like, the Black Stig time.
Yeah.
And I rattled around. First, he showed me where the track went, because that's not obvious, because it's an airfield. So there's no obvious corners. There's lots of white lines and other things. I rattled around. He looked very, and it's a standing start, which is unusual, because from race, we do, consecutive laps. So that was strange. And he was clamping down on a stopwatch, which I thought was fairly untechnical. And he looked very nonplussed and unimpressed with what I was doing. And he said, is that as fast as you can go? I said, yeah.
No, is that what he said?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's a killer line, isn't it?
It's a killer line. I'd done about 5 or 6 runs. And I said, yeah, I mean, how am I doing? He's like, yeah, it's not bad. It's like, great. So I thought it had gone the way of John Bentley, and I heard nothing from them. And it was a funny time. And I, my racing seemed to have stopped. So I was like looking for other things to do. And I literally joined the army. I had joined pretty much the territorial army to go and do.
Is that right? I didn't know that. I didn't know all this. Wow.
Yeah. It was 2002. Our Le Mans car got destroyed, which was had a suspension fail. It was a mistake, and that was the end of that program.
Mm.
And within the space of the month, I got this audition, and then wonderfully, about a couple of months later, I got a drive, and off the back of a race I did with you actually in Ascar. Mm. But at that time, nothing. And I waited a month. Well, I didn't wait. There was just nothing from the Top Gear mob. Heard nothing, except for a month later, and it's like, can you come back to the track on Tuesday? And that was it. I turned up on Tuesday. There was a white suit and a helmet, and I had the job. And apparently my time had been very fast and quicker than what they had in other hands. And but Wilman, poker face, nothing.
Yeah, wow.
Is that the fastest you can do?
And he was like that for the whole 8 years.
Was he?
Yeah.
Good
hilarious.
Lord.
He's a fun guy.
He doesn't
give wow, what a story, eh?
I know.
Amazing.
And just to have been, it's such a strange vantage point, I suppose, as well, but an interesting vantage point to have been an integral part of that show, which was and still is massive. But during that era, when it got reinvented with Clarkson, Hammond and May, and for you to be there all the time, completely incognito, with even them not knowing who you are, it's brilliant. I love it.
Yeah, it was funny. Well, and I ended up looking at back. I mean, when I started it, my dream was to go racing as the Stig. That seemed to be the calling. It could have been fantastic. I just hadn't envisaged that they would interpret that as racing a diesel BMW in a 24-hour brick car race in the fog. I had higher ambitions, never realised. I still, that could have been the thing. There were so many ifs and woulds and maybes, but it was a fantastic time. But I had no idea what direction it would all go in. And we were all, there were lots of people feeding ideas in, some of which got put on the screen. So I ended up doing a few bits as Ben. One of them, so two or three I sort of pitched. One was, we can land a parachutist into a back of a car.
Yeah.
Car football was a kind of,
I remember that one.
An idea that I'd sort
like
of
in Igos or something, wasn't it? Were they little Toyotas? Yeah.
Yes.
Five-a-side. Plato would have been in his element. It would have been a very short match, but he'd have gone straight in T-bone. Well,
do you know what? We did a thing on our last series of Driven. We did a thing called Car Sumo. which was a similar sort of little mini cars bashing into each other. But yeah, that car football looks fun. Looks great.
It was awesome. It was really well. So it was quite well organized. And they had Russ Swift in there, who's a famous precision driver. He can handbrake into a parking space.
Yeah.
And, you know, growing up, I was aware of him. And then, you know, into filming, he's, you know, he's got this sort of Yoda like quality about him.
Yes.
So he was there, and he definitely had, he sort of arrived with a bit of an aura. And I'd learned a bit about filming by that point. And then you had the touring car mob. But we were told, look, we've got these five cars each side. We can do this thing. We've never done it before. And sort of worked out what you could do with this ball. And actually, you worked, you could dribble it. If you got a bit of speed, the air would hold the ball on the bonnet of the car.
Okay.
Basically,
yeah.
Made you stop. And you could punt it and do stuff like that. And we were told not to make contact. But even in that, at that, in that phase, people were starting to make contacts. And it's amazing how, like, you know, culture in a race can change. People's boundaries adjust. And this guy, Russ, he was the first one to sort of start, right, fender bending gently. I was like, geez, you know, he's the precise, Mr. Precision, and he's quite aggressive. And he would just rock it in. If you didn't stop, he'd have hit you at 60 miles an hour. And I sort of, you know, I went to the ref. And it was, you know, director, I knew well. I think it was James Bryce directing that one. And he was very specific, you know, about how we should behave. And he said, okay, now we can take the ante up slightly. We are permitting some contact. And then that was it. That was game on.
It's Glenn Ferrell.
Yeah, wheels ripped off. steam coming out of radiators, the whole thing. It was carnage. And it was over very quickly.
So I tell you what I'm interested about is towards the end of the Top Gear Stig time, there was the book. Mm. And there was there a big fallout with that, if you can speak about it?
Yeah, there was. I mean, so at that point, I'd been there a long time. And the identity part was beginning to crack. There were leaks, basically. And I was having a permanent battle. Well, so YouTube had bubbled up, this voice recording. And Wikipedia was a thing.
Right.
And people were, it was on Wikipedia that Ben Collins was the Stig, and we kept trying to change it and put Damon Hill. Say we, I couldn't really be doing it. But there was a lot, there were these, you know, trying to plug these holes, basically.
Yeah.
And in 2008, the Radio Times, which is BBC, for some reason, they did a front page cover, who is the Stig? The nation needs to know. And then inside was my picture and bio.
This is the BBC, sorry, eating itself effectively, isn't it now?
Basically, yeah. And to be fair, there were two of us in there. They had Russ Swift in there too. But Russ, it was, you know, not the right age. And also, he's not a racing driver. So in this thing, you knew it was a racing person.
Yeah.
So it was really, really obvious. And the newspapers that were watching this thought, well, sod this. We've kind of known for a while. And they started running articles. So it was quite dangerous ground. I started hearing all kinds of, you know when the writing's on the wall and you can see an atmosphere is changed. Yeah. I knew all the time, this is about anonymity and you've got to stay anonymous and all that. And actually my sort of situation was always kept really quite tight there. I was hired one day at a time. So you knew you were living in, your job lived on that anonymity. Right. And that started to get quite endangered, basically. So I thought, you know, this is coming to an end one way or the other. So it's time to go. And so I, you know, made notes on the stuff I'd enjoyed the most and looked about setting up when I was going to leave. Had it in my notice, had a book ready to go because I thought it was a great story.
Yeah.
Told, you know, and I was completely open about it. And then all hell broke loose, as they say.
I'm off and here's this 500 pager.
Here's this thing, yeah. But
Absolutely.
I love writing. I've always enjoyed writing. And let's face it, all the presenters have written books and had a great time. Yeah. If I was going to leave the show, it'd be daft not to have, you know,
get, of course,
you know, put something out there that people also enjoy the story. So I was hoping that we'd have a conversation around, you know, killing off that character or whatever they wanted to do. But in the end, it became a bit more combative than that, which is a shame. So I ended up having, I got sued. BBC put an injunction on the book. I had to go to the High Court and sort of defend it. And, you know, at the end of the day, you know, the judge was reading about, with my name, the whole thing in the newspaper on the day of the case. It was sort of untenable to say that it was a secret anymore. So the book got published, The Man in the White Suit, and we all lived happily ever after. And we have made up since. So, I mean, I never intended it to be a sort of vindictive move. It was just, I just felt it's time to go. 8 years is a long time, and yeah, it's time for something different.
So, I mean, so now, you know, if you run into, and, you know, I suppose you must do at some point, if you run into Clarkson or Hammond or Willman or Porsche.
He tried to run into me. He tried to get me with a tractor, but I was too fast.
But joking aside, is everything okay now? Should you run into each other at the Autosport Awards or something like that? Is it okay, or is it still a bit bad?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was 2 years after I left, they all left. I ended up doing a film with them. It was quite funny. It was at Thruxton. So they were pretending that they'd forgotten how to present. Mm-hmm. And I was pretending that I'd been sleeping rough for the last 2 years. So they found me in my stick suit with the gloves had become fingerless gloves. And I was drinking some meth by the look of it. I went and did that film with them, which was really fun. So that was quite a nice way to see them. I've been on prior to that, actually back on Top Gear with the guys, the army veterans who were doing the Dakar rally.
Yeah.
So we did do that sort of on camera making up. So I think Willman was the first one who put the olive branch out. We kissed and made up. And then the presenters I've got to see, you know, subsequently and catch up with them. But I did, you know, I wrote to all of them when I left and said, look, you know, wish you all well. And and now with Hamster, he's got the Drive Tribe channel. And I've been working on that on YouTube and getting my little Ben Collins Drives channel going. Which is doing very nicely now. So that, and partly thanks to working on Drive Tribe with Richard. So, you know, he's doing great things there and we have a good laugh and speak pretty regularly.
Good. The Stig springboard, if you like, and however it sort of ended and actually maybe in some ways the fact that it ended with a sort of element of controversy and whatever could actually have been better in the long run. It probably did better for the book. It probably did better for your platform. But that was a real springboard, arguably, to then getting you into the Hollywood stuff, wasn't it? I mean, the Stig platform must have helped with that in terms of doing the James Bond things, would you say?
It may have done a bit, but although, weirdly, I mean, because it was a secret, I couldn't go around with a CV that says, oh, I'm the Stig, by the way, so you should hire me.
But you could after the event, though, surely. Yeah. I mean,
I could, but I started, though, before I left Top Gear. So in 2000, okay. I mean, around that time, I was starting to do car commercials, which is something I've, you know, done for 20 years now. And it was through that I started to get introductions to into movies. And actually, but you know, and I had a break from a guy called Gary Powell, who's a career stunt guy and stunt coordinator, second unit director. But he got going in the Bond movies, and he very kindly recommended me into another film. So my first film was in 2007, National Treasure 2. Mm-hmm. I was doing a bit of doubling for Nicolas Cage and also terrifying
check you out.
A car in a thing called a pod where you sit on the roof and drive from up top and the poor actor's in there with no control over anything except his lines or her lines. And that was my first intro. So it was a big car chase in London. So that side of it had sort of, you know, it was a parallel career, if you like. But again with the racing, same thing. You know, I couldn't go down the pit lane saying, look at me, I'm on telly. So in some ways frustrating, but it was part of the job. But so now I had to sort of keep going out there as Ben Collins. Subsequently, yes, it's been great to have had to move on and do different things.
I can imagine you've seen some amazing places going with the movies, especially with Bond, and actually done some really, really cool stuff, like cool stunts.
Yeah, this pinch yourself moment when you was sitting there in a pinstripe suit with Bond's Omega watch in an Aston Martin at Lake Garda. That's like, wow, how did this happen? A pretty amazing opportunity and faith, really, because the guys who do stunts, that's their life. They've been doing that. They've been training for it. They're incredibly skilled and talented. And fortunately, I was able to adapt racing skills to stunt world. TV helps with that because, you know, you're often sort of sliding around for camera because it's entertaining and it's also interesting to see how the car behaves when it's on the edge of control or a bit beyond. So for sure, the TV stuff really helps cement that. But nevertheless, being there doing that, and it's a whole different animal. Your TV crews, you know, you think that they're pretty big when there's 15 people. Try it when there's 200 people, you know, up and down on a lakeside with these incredible and expensive camera systems all pointing in one direction, and you know, you do think you get more than one take at stuff, and sometimes you do, but sometimes there isn't more than one take. There's the one, So if you screw it up, there's 200 people going, oh, what we did, what did you do that for?
Mm.
But it's incredibly well choreographed. And we, you know, we rehearsed for over a month to get those sequences dialed. And then, you know, you need that because you're going then head on with the truck down a, you know, a tight ravine with a sheer drop on one side, mountain on the other. And those, you know, it's got to be pinpoint accurate. So it's very different process to TV. It's awesome fun.
Yeah, but I mean, at the risk of asking a silly question here, and in terms of exactly what you're talking about, where you're talking about stunts and cliff faces and ravines and all that kind of stuff, bearing in mind, you're obviously a highly skilled driver. We know that from your racing career. But then transferring that into the sort of precision that you need for these stunts and for the movies is quite a different technique. How on earth do you practice that? Because, you know, one would assume that practice makes perfect, and the only way to refine that skill and that accuracy is by try again. But how on earth do you do that in your own time when you're not? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get what you mean. So we'll lay out specifics that you'll rehearse to. But there, for instance, there's another one in Jack Ryan. I had to drive a van, like an American Dodge van. It was a police van, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It had been modified, so it had a handbrake in it. I had to make sure that worked. But I had to spin it 90 degrees and block the tunnel. And on each end of the van, there was about 2 inches to spare. I measured it, you know, to the tunnel. I was like, this is going to look bad if I get this wrong. Because it's going to rip pieces off the machine and it's going to look stupid and I'll look crap. And I said, look, to do that, can I have an hour over there in the car park? So that's what I did. So I, you know, measured it out, got the cones, and then just rehearsed it and practiced. Which is, you know, similar to racing. We get data. You can look at what your teammates do, and you go, he is doing something in that chicane that is better than what I'm doing at the moment. So I've got to get my head right. And you start looking at, you pick it apart, work it out, and then go and do it. Steal his time. Thank you very much for the lesson. And I suppose with this, it's so you do learn to be self-taught. I think a lot of sports people do. Mm. I noticed that with teaching at Top Gear. You know, you often find the sports people. You know, they've worked how things work. So did the same thing, practiced it in the car park, and then threw it together on the day, and it worked. And the director was very kind. He saw it, and I think he was like, "Oh crap, that's extremely tight." And he just said, "Park it, put the handbrake on, and walk away." He didn't make me do it 6 times. I said, Thank you very much. So that's Vic Armstrong, who was Harrison Ford's stuntman and everything else all through those Indiana Jones years, and a wonderful guy. So he could see that would be a hard one to get right every on the button each time.
Yeah.
He was happy with the first take, so that was that.
So say like on the Bond movies, how long are you away for? You know, when you go away on location, are you away for weeks and weeks and weeks on end?
Months.
Months?
Yeah. So Skyfall, I think, was 3.5-4 months. And we were working 6 day weeks, long hours, and you just couldn't really, you know, so we stayed in Turkey for that whole period. So 3.5 months away, which is a long time.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the crews away for long. I mean, the movie takes 9 months, usually something big like that. Let's say 5 to 9 months, depending on what the shoot is. The driving bit will be a segment of that, or it might be dotted around, but then there'll be a main action unit that will focus on those action scenes. And Bond is always, you know, it's real. So they don't go for CGI. So they go for these extended sequences that are pretty awesome. So you'll do the rehearsals and then you go and shoot it. So I mean, Quantum of Solace was 3 months, I think, and on screen 1.5 minutes, something like that.
Unbelievable.
Wild, isn't it?
I mean, it literally is incredible, isn't it?
As a little boy growing up, and you obviously had aspirations to drive cars and race cars and whatnot, but then to actually sort of transcend that into a whole different world, Jason, you know, in terms of actually being there on the Bond set as part of the live action unit. I mean, it's just proper pinch yourself moments, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I can imagine.
It's out there. Well, I mean, yeah, daft stuff as well. Like I was in one of the original DB5s. And I looked and I noticed that this is on Skyfall. I noticed that the gear lever had a flip top, you know, like thing on it. So I flipped that open as a red button. And I was like, don't press it.
How cool is that? Don't press it.
Don't press it. And I was talking to Ben Cook, who was the sort of stunt double for, he was the stunt double for Daniel in that film. So he did all the fight stuff. And he's like, oh, yeah. And he's a Kiwi and I can't do his accent. But he's like, yeah. And he said, oh, yeah. Did you push it? And I said, no. He said, oh, I did. I'm like, you know, what happened? Nothing. Nothing happened. And I ended up, a friend of mine gave me a day on set, because I'm a huge Star Wars fan. He gave me a day on set for Rogue One as a stormtrooper. And I thought, same thing. My opposite number was, he knew how excited I was. He said, go on, you know, give the blaster a go. So I thought, you know, I didn't take advantage of the button on Bond. Let's at least pull the trigger on this thing. And it went off on set, on the Death Star. This thing started banging and lights went off and everything. I was like, oh my God. And he thought it wasn't a working one. He said, oh yeah, some of them work. Sorry about that. But
brilliant.
Like a real plum. But no, I didn't want to press the ejector seat. That would have been bad.
Take me back for a second to what you were describing before with, did you say it was a pod? So am I right in thinking that for a movie scene, so you've actually got a real car with real actors, but the actual controlling of that driving is done by you on the roof? Is that what you meant?
Yeah, that's it. It's quite strange. You're high up, so it's like driving a tractor. So yeah. You're way out. You know, so you're literally sitting on a roof rack, and all the pedals and the gearing and everything like that is diverted. So there's different systems they can use. The one I was in the first time was a hydraulic system. Mm-hmm. So that's more like driving a boat. And you can turn quite a few times to get it to turn fully to the right or left. And the center will move because there's some float in the system and there's a bit of nuance to it. Plus the fact when you pull the handbrake, it feels like everything's about to tip over and you're right up there. Yeah. So if it does, the first thing you're going to know about it is you're going to get slapped in the head. But it's well balanced. You can adjust the car a little bit to sort of take the load off. But there's a lot of different systems. So, sometimes on the roof, sometimes they're on the back. Another one I drove, so I also worked on Han Solo. And mm-hmm. That was amazing. So we had the land speeder, Han Solo's land speeder. And in that one, we basically hung the pob was off the front of that on the nose. Which again feels strange because when you're sliding it around something like around a building, your nose is on the building as you go around.
Yeah.
Quite odd. You saw very well, oh, that's just the front of the car, just rub past that. You are the front of the car.
Well, do you know what? I can imagine as well, because our you know, the queuing we get as drivers and feeling cars is pretty conditioned to us being somewhere near where the center of gravity is or being in the middle of the car.
Yeah.
So you can feel through the seat of your pants and through your body, you can feel what's happening. But if you're on the front of the car, you won't feel any yaw at all. And I can imagine that's discombobulating.
Yeah. It's different.
Because you're feeling something completely different.
Yeah, you get used to quite a few rough sensations. I think I've enjoyed that. Like being on the roof, though, I think is, for me, the roughest. Because the sensations are amplified.
Yeah.
But actually, funnily enough, I mean, you do sense some yaw. I mean, I don't know if you ever drove the Panos race car. That was mind-blowing because you're sitting on the back axle.
On the back, yes.
Yeah, with this huge, long hood in front of you, all engine, and you're right. And when the car starts to slide, you're right on the rear axle. So it feels massively amplified and it's quite unusual to get used to. And actually, I drove it at Atlanta, and as you go up the hill, you actually can't see anything. And
because of the bonnet.
Because of the bonnet.
Yeah.
And they said there's two types of driver. There's one who never gets past not being able to see past the bonnet, and the ones that do. He said, well done. But it was quite strange because your brain adapts to and starts to roll ahead anticipate what you're going into. It does take getting used to.
Wow. Mate, we're meant to be talking about cars, Dave, aren't we?
I know, but you know what? But this is
it
so
is good, though, isn't
this
it?
This is so much more interesting. Yeah. You know, normally we ask you about your first car and your car history and blah, 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 which we may or may not do in a minute, but this is fascinating. I love it. And I mean, what does a normal week look like for you now? You know, is there such a thing? Is there a normal week or a normal month, or are you literally just going from one mad job to another?
That's how it's been, I think. It's been really, you know, really great fun. I just did 6 weeks in Italy on a new movie about Enzo Ferrari.
Mm-hmm.
That's coming out next year. That's going to be awesome. So that was Michael Mann has directed that. He's got huge kudos in Hollywood and he's a fantastic director. Last of the Mohicans is one of his. Heat, one of my favorite films with that incredible shootout. Yeah. So very gritty, hard-hitting, great, you know, very well put together movies. And I think this one will be pretty awesome. So that was great. So there isn't really a standard week. Although I think looking ahead, I think that probably is more likely to be the case, you know, for next year and beyond, because I'm really keen to go for it on the YouTube. For me, that's the next opportunity to really make the most of. And that, I think, is exciting. So I'm looking to probably, as I look back, it's a lot of the stuff I used to do as the Stig, coaching people. So I've started, you know, had a great day out with Dizzy Rascal, teaching him donuts and all this mad sort of stuff. So there'll be a bit like that, but not constrained by just being at one track, just in a Suzuki Liana. So, you know, the idea is to go anywhere in the world with whoever we, you know, we can get onto the program and have at it. Review, cool new cars, all that good stuff. So so that'd be me, and hopefully that'd be a bit more, for me, a little bit more, I suppose, structured, so I know what I'm doing from 1 week to the next. It probably won't work like that at all.
No, it probably won't. But in theory, it should actually allow you more time at home and more time to be slightly more settled than you have been at late with the movie work.
Exactly. That's the plan. So we'll see.
Wow. Come on then, Ben. Give us some inside goss on that Daniel Craig. Is he a good bloke? Is he a nice guy? Is he a dick? Is he? What is he?
He's funny. I really like him. He's got a cracking sense of humour. He's obviously he's an amazing actor. That's obvious. First time I met him was his second film, and he realised that he's had the kitchen sink thrown at him. He's been doing fight classes. Then he was with me, and I was doing sort of drift Kana with him at Dunsfold, getting him to sort of drift this high, you know, an Aston Martin that could do 200 miles an hour. And not surprisingly, I'm a bloody actor. And I'm an actor. I'm not actually James Bond. You know, it's like you've got to sort of realize that it's a lot to take in for anybody who's stepping into those shoes. So I think he's, you know, nailed it. The fight sequences, the driving stuff that he does is great. But yeah, he's got great sense of humor. So we're out in on Spectre, which I didn't do very much on. I don't know, he was just tuning into some oriental music on the radio, which I thought was just really out of context for the snow-kissed woods that we were hanging out with in a Range Rover. But I think, yeah, he's just always looking at the funny angle. He's a good guy. He's definitely a good dude.
Wow. Can you imagine, Dave, what it must be like to be Daniel Craig?
Well, I can imagine he would be quite dry, I think, in terms of, in a good way, in terms of his sense of humour. But also, as you say, Ben, you know, when you're spending that much time with people, you must really get to know the real person, because they can't keep up the veneer for that long. And if you are literally sort of spending hours and hours sat in a car with somebody or sitting on set with somebody, you must get to know the real person very quickly, I'd imagine.
Do you know what? I'd love to have hung out with him more than I did. It's just, but the driving side of it, it tends to be quite sort of dislocated. So the guys that spend the most time with are the main, if you like, the stunt double. So, you know, I can mention Ben Cook, Andy Lister, Dave Grant, who did doubled him in the last movie. These guys are incredible athletes, and they will spend, you know, weeks doing preparation. So with the driving, you know, it's a smaller part, if you like, of the film. So you collaborate on those bits. So I don't get to spend as much time with the guys as you might think, but it is funny when you do. Like, yeah, you know, and I did. There was another scene. It was nothing really, but at Siena, we had to swoop into Bond's lair. But there was half an inch into this tunnel for the wing mirrors, and it was, you know, I had to drive around in one clean movement and get it in there. Mm. So I jumped in to do that bit. He was watching that and just going, I think probably thinking, I hope he crashes it. I don't know if that's what he wants. If I was, I'd be thinking the same thing. Got to the end, and this is when Mr. White has been, you know, basically trapped in the boot of the car the whole time through the massive carnage car chase around Garda, and he kicks him out. And they just wanted me to line up and just sort of do a bit of a walk around the car, which I did like a complete chump, because I'm not a good actor. I'm not as cool as Bond. And Daniel said, "Well, just sit back down. I'll do this."
I've got this. Did it
perfectly, like adjusted the suit, the walk, the pace, the measured, everything was just really, really cool. It's like, yeah, that's why you do that job, and I just drive the car occasionally. I think this is right.
It is a real skill, that, isn't it? It's a real skill to act.
Mm. Yeah,
even to walk cool. Yeah. There's a way to do it, and most people can't, and there are a few that can. It's very skillful, isn't it?
Yeah, and you should see them when they're training, you know, with these things and being. When you look at the jumps and the falls and all those things, you know, and even the driving elements that he's done. He's done every single aspect of the action sequence and been part of it. So it's a hell of a thing, as well as all the storyline and all that stuff they have to deal with. Yeah. So, yeah, hats off. Pretty impressive. Well,
interesting, eh, Dave?
You ever thought about being Daniel Craig's stunt double, Jason? You know, his future career now that touring cars is coming to an end?
I've tried to put those blue shorts on many times in the past, and I just can't. They're a bit too tight now.
Coming out the sea in Bognor.
Out the sea, yeah. I mean, there was a time, you know, 15 years ago, where I did reckon on holiday once, walking up the beach out the breaking waters.
I think you're past it.
I might have it.
Once you get, we get late, you know, as life goes on, it's funny how there's something that starts stealing your backside and putting it the back section of men, it just becomes a straight line, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then there's this funny little other little bulges that appear elsewhere.
Mm. Yeah. I have them normally in the winter, and it's called my winter belly.
Yeah.
And now that seems to be going into the spring and the summer.
Yeah.
Has that happened to you yet?
I hope not. Maybe I'm just blind to it. But
yeah, either that or maybe,
I'm sure they'll point it out.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes it's difficult to see without an elaborate setup of mirrors. Do you know what, Jason? Normally we would ask our guests, wouldn't we, about their car history. But, you know, quite frankly, when the comparison is conversations about hanging out with Daniel Craig and doing sort of stunt scenes in Bond, really the whole whether I had a Ford Fiesta or not is largely pedestrian, I think. However, I would like to find out about Mr. Collins' fantasy drive, and I think you are the man to ask that.
Okay. So, we always think, Ben, that, you know, cars, music, location, they all go really well together. So your fantasy drive, where are you? Where are you going to? What are you listening to? And more importantly, what car are you in?
Bloody hell.
Can be anywhere in the world.
Mm.
Wow. Where am I going? I don't know. I've got a clue. Okay, I've got to start with the car then. Yeah. So this is pick any car and ain't going any place. Yep.
Anything.
Yeah.
Something which rocks your, you know, rocks your boat.
The ultimate driving place. If it's on a track, I still maintain you can't get more insane and more out there and more challenging and more fun than a lap of Macau. Mm-hmm. And I still hunger for that. And I take almost anything round there. Then there's the insane part of me that's probably spent too much time doing sim racing that would want to take something like my Ascari, you know, LMP1, 850 horsepower thing around there. I don't think it's very sensible, but that would be something. That would be it. It would be like, it would basically be that, surrounded by all the casinos and paraphernalia and madness of Macau. I definitely want an ambulance on standby for that one, and a strong drink at the end of it. I think with you boys, so I'll have a drink with you in the Mandarin Oriental. If I could survive 10 laps, that would be probably one of the drives of my life.
Sounds perfect, mate, doesn't it?
Does or trip across the Cotswolds. In anything that I've got as a daily, that's always gorgeous. Any time of year, it's just great, especially in the winter, though, when it's like the, you know, you get the frost. I don't know, there's so many, aren't there? PCH in California, driving that state. But no, for ultimate, if we could talk about ultimates, I think I still want to go back. Have you raced there, Jason?
Do you know what? I haven't. No, I've not had the chance. I mean, I said years ago that I wouldn't, once I got married, I wouldn't ever set foot in Macau.
Okay. You'd need to be kept in a bubble. Yeah. You would have to be sort of like cultivated in an airstream or something like that.
I know so many drivers have gone adrift out there.
Yeah, and mechanics. We nearly lost one that way. it is funny. I mean, yeah, we did literally nearly lost a guy. But it's a hell of a place. If you can try and control yourself outside of the car, but going around it as a lap is just mind boggling. Because I think I've raced a couple of street circuits prior, as well as Macau, but it's the only one where you use the wall. I mean, with a single seater, where the car, you actually lean on the wall with the rubber, and after a lap, the markings on the side of the you know, tires are gone because you're just hitting things, and your brain just has to function on a different level. It's quite surreal. But the first time I went, it was all kind of happening quite fast. And I was going around the track and everything, But it was really, it was the second time I went, it really clicked. And you just have this sort of attacking approach that's unlike any other track. And it's a sort of miracle that you get around each lap until you don't. But it's a lot of fun.
Listen, Jason, we will see him at the end of that for a cheeky little sundown. And I promise you, I will look after your Macau. And I promise you that you won't go sideways.
Oh, thanks. Right. Let's do it, Dave.
Let's do it.
There's plenty of guides. We can get some guides. We need guides.
Indeed. And on that note, Jason, I think you need to take us out, mate.
Right, that's it for this week's Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save your money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, big thanks. But a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only Ben Collins. Thanks, pal.
Thanks, on me, guys. See you soon. Happy Christmas.
Brilliant, fascinating stories. Don't forget you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you like what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, everybody. And, well, I look forward to seeing you next time. Ta-da.